and I hope you never have to pull off another stunt like this one."
"Me too."
She wasn't even sure now how she had done it. She was just compensating for the havoc Jason had wrought and the angle he had put the plane in at low altitude, and by some miracle it had worked. "Could we have dinner sometime when you're in New York, to celebrate the fact that we got through this?" It didn't sound like a date, just combat buddies grateful for their return from a tough mission in one piece.
"That would be nice," she said easily. "They just gave me a month off, so it won't be for a while," she added,
relieved that the press conference was over. Reporters had directed their toughest questions at management for not realizing how mentally unstable Jason was and firing him before this. But he was smart and charming when he wanted to be, and Helen could see how he had slipped through the cracks. Even she had just thought he was a smartass and a harmless, badly behaved boy, and he was a great deal worse than that. He was a murderer who wanted to take 110 people with him and had no remorse about it whatsoever before his death. He thought the airline deserved it for depriving him of what he considered his rightful place, so killing innocent people made sense to him and didn't matter. But it was hard to justify to the press, and ultimately the public, that they hadn't fired him before it got to that point. The airline had a major challenge ahead of them, and they knew it. The CEO had been deeply apologetic, and they all knew there would be major lawsuits as a result. Helen got ready to leave then, and shook hands with Ben and Tom again, and the others, and with the CEO, who thanked her profusely. And then she left the room to meet up with the driver. Ben took off right after she did, and saw her drive away in the town car. She had her uniform hat off and had removed her tie. Her shoulder-length hair was blowing in the evening breeze, and she was smiling at the prospect of seeing her children and spending a month at home with them. She owed them that after the fright they'd had the day before because of her. Ben waited for Phil, and they had dinner that night at a great steakhouse. They drank a lot of wine, and Ben was drunk when he got back to his hotel room, and he didn't care at all. He knew he had earned it. When Helen turned into the driveway in the unfamiliar car, all the children looked out the window, let out a shout when they saw it was her, and ran down the front steps to throw their arms around her as she got out. They almost knocked her down, and she followed them into the house where Lisa, the babysitter, had baked a cake for her, and she had helped Lally make cupcakes for her. Lally insisted Helen eat one immediately. They were her favorites, Lally pointed out, red velvet and dark chocolate, and Oliver and Jimmy were standing by at attention, waiting to hug her again. They couldn't get enough of her, nor she of them.
"I thought you drowned, or a big fish ate you," Lally said, looking worried.
"I'm a good swimmer, and I'm not going to let a fish eat me, Lally. And I have a month's vacation." She had been thinking about it on the drive home, and thought of taking them to Disneyland. She wanted to do something fun with them, to celebrate the fact that she was alive. Suddenly, that was all that mattered. She wanted their time together to be about life, not death. They'd had too much of that in recent years. Her father was at the house, too, waiting patiently to see her, and all five of them sat at the kitchen table and had dinner together. Tim went out and got pizzas and two roast chickens, and it felt like a feast to Helen. Life seemed suddenly normal again, although two men had died in her cockpit the day before. Her father couldn't bear the thought that it might have been her, or that the co-pilot could have flown them into the bridge and killed them all, as he intended. Nothing seemed safe in the world today, but destiny had protected her this time. It was all they could ask for. He hadn't worried about her this much since she was in the military, although he tried not to show it. Lally slept in her mother's bed that night, and they finished the cupcakes for breakfast the next morning. She had gotten them organized for school, and Helen smiled as she looked at her children at the kitchen table. Life was sweet. And however frightening the scene had been 2 days before, miraculously she had survived. It made every moment with them even sweeter. Chapter 14. Like the rest of the crew that had been on Helen's flight, Nancy had been given 2 weeks off. and Peter traded his trips for the next week to give them time together. They spent the next day in bed, sleeping and relaxing and watching movies, and that night she dug through her closet to find something to wear, and found a dusty rose-colored silk suit that seemed like the right attire for a matron of honor. Joel hadn't given her any details about the wedding, except that the ceremony was at 4 o'clock at City Hall, and Kevin's parents were giving them a reception afterward at the Ritz-Carlton. But she had no idea how many people would be there or how dressy it would be when she teased him into inviting her. Peter wasn't sure what to wear either, since it was their first gay wedding, and they agreed that a dark suit would be a safe choice. They arrived at City Hall a few minutes before the appointed hour, and Nancy was startled when Joel introduced her to his mother. He had said that his very conservative family had never accepted the fact that he was gay, and Nancy was impressed to find herself face to face with a tall, attractive, youthful-looking woman, who looked just like Joel, in a chic navy blue dinner suit, and she smiled warmly at Nancy and Peter. After Joel had gone to greet several men who had just arrived, in suits similar to Peter's, Joel's mother spoke to Nancy in a quiet tone. "I just found out about the wedding yesterday. Joel has always been very private about his life," she said carefully, "and his father has never accepted the fact that he's gay. It's been very difficult for Joel. I'm glad he's happy now. It meant a lot to me that he called to tell me and invited me to the wedding. I wouldn't miss it. And Kevin is a wonderful man. I flew in from Salt Lake this morning. I asked my husband to come, but he just can't do it. But here I am," she said proudly, and Nancy was pleased for Joel. He whispered to Nancy about it a few minutes later, as he pinned a small white rose to her lapel, so people would know she was the matron of honor, and he had a white orchid for his mother to wear that he'd ordered at the last minute after he called her. "Do you believe it? My mother came. She loves Kevin." It was a difficult breakthrough for him. "I decided to call her when we were getting out of the plane. I thought if I lived through it, I'd give it one more try with them. You never know, do you?" He was beaming, and Kevin's mother kissed him several times and stood next to Joel's mother during the ceremony. They had two best men, their closest friends who were also partners who had gotten married, and Nancy standing near them as witnesses, about a dozen friends and their parents. The ceremony was serious and respectful, performed by a judge, which was the only disappointment for Joel's mother, she admitted later. She would have preferred a minister. Joel and Kevin exchanged narrow gold wedding bands and had written their vows, which moved Nancy to tears, even more so when she remembered how close she and Joel had come to being killed 2 days before, and realized their friends and families could have been attending a funeral, not a wedding, which was a grim thought, and she shuddered when it crossed her mind. Both mothers cried when Joel and Kevin were officially pronounced married, and everyone embraced the couple after the ceremony. Kevin had arranged for a white-coated waiter to be outside the room in the hallway and pour champagne into plastic cups. And the atmosphere was instantly festive. Everyone was happy for them. An hour later, they drove to the Ritz-Carlton, where Kevin's parents had rented a beautiful reception room with a garden, and a small band was playing their favorite songs. And there was a buffet for about 80 people. Nancy couldn't remember a wedding she had enjoyed as much, or which had been as tastefully done. She danced with Peter before and after dinner, and he stayed close to her all night. Having nearly lost her, he didn't want to let her out of his sight. And Nancy could see that Kevin was feeling the same way. It had been a wake-up call for all of them that the worst could happen and life could change in the blink of an eye. At 10 o'clock, Joel threw a bouquet to the single men and women in the group, and Kevin's niece caught it and was thrilled. The wedding cake had been made by one of the best bakeries in San Francisco and was spectacular, with two grooms on it. Everything had been done with style and beauty and impeccable taste. Not a single detail had been overlooked. The flowers throughout the room were exquisite. Joel's mother left shortly after 10 to catch her flight back to Salt Lake City, and she had a quiet, healing moment with her son, and looked genuinely sorry to leave. She promised to come back and visit soon. And at midnight, Kevin and Joel got ready to leave their guests.
Their flight to Tahiti was leaving at the crack of dawn. The wedding had been absolutely perfect. "If you ever decide to give up flying, you have a new career all lined up," Nancy said to Joel when she kissed him goodbye and wished him a wonderful trip. "You'd be a fabulous wedding planner," she complimented him. "Kevin did everything. All I did was say yes or no and cut a few pictures out of magazines." He looked lovingly across the room at his husband and then looked at Nancy seriously. "I keep thinking how lucky we were this week." She nodded, understanding what he meant. She felt the same way, and to be pregnant on top of it was the icing on the cake. She had seen her doctor the day before and confirmed that everything was fine, which was a huge relief. "I'm glad I called my mom," Joel continued. "I think it meant a lot to her, and it did to me, too, to have her here. I always feel like an orphan with no family, although Kevin's family had embraced him like their own son. My mom gave me back a piece of myself by being here and putting her stamp of approval on my life," Joel said with emotion. "It's too bad my father can't get there, too. It's hard on my brother, who leads a secret life to keep them happy. I just couldn't do that anymore. At least my mom came." He kissed Nancy goodbye again. Most of the guests left at the same time, as the orchestra played "Happy Trails to You," and the party ended. "I had a really good time," Peter said to Nancy. "It was the nicest wedding I've ever been to, except ours." He smiled and kissed her as the valet brought them their car and they got in. And he looked serious for a moment on the way home. "We need to talk about what we're going to do about Beijing now." She nodded. It had been on her mind, too. "If we're going to back out, we should do it soon."
"Do you think we should?"
she asked him sadly.
"I don't know. How do you feel about having two kids?"
"That doesn't worry me. I like the idea. I just wonder if we'd feel differently about having an adopted child and one of our own. I don't want to be unfair to her."
"I'm sure that we'd come to love her as much as our own. Our biological child could turn out to be a brat," he said, teasing her as they drove home.
"Let's think about it," Nancy said, wanting to do the right thing, still coasting on the warm feelings of the evening. It had been a beautiful night.
Ellen had Scott in her arms when she visited Robert in jail, the day after she arrived, 2 days after Robert had kidnapped him from her parents' house. Robert had been arraigned the day after he was arrested. He was charged with parental abduction, and the judge had set bail. But Robert hadn't paid it and had nothing to post as bond. He looked depressed when he came to the phone in the visiting area. The baby stretched his arms out to him, but they were separated by a sheet of bulletproof glass and had to communicate over the phone.
"What happened to you? Why did you do it? I nearly went crazy when I discovered he was gone,"
Ellen said to him. "I thought he'd been kidnapped by someone who snuck into my parents' house." There were tears in her eyes as she said it, and he could see how upset she was. He hadn't thought of that when he took Scott. He had left her a note, but she said she hadn't found it for several hours. He had left it on the piano in her parents' living room on his way out, and no one ever looked there.
"I don't know. I think I went crazy for a minute. Everything went so wrong with us. We got married, and our parents were on our backs all the time. I thought it was going to be exciting and romantic and fun. And instead, you bitched at me all the time. All of a sudden, you didn't like my friends. I drank too much. I couldn't smoke weed in the house. My job wasn't good enough. I didn't make enough money."
She winced when he said it, and couldn't deny it. It was all true. He'd been 23 years old, and she was 22. She had thought that marriage would make him grow up, and he'd be more like her father. Instead, she saw how immature he was. He wanted to go out with his friends every night or have them hang around and mess up their apartment, which he never cleaned up. And all he wanted to do with them was go to concerts or get drunk or stoned.
"And then you got pregnant, and it all got worse. You were sick all the time. You talked about the baby all the time. And I had to be a father. And when you had him, you never let me near him.
Your parents pay for everything, so they think they own us. And mine never help us, which I agree is shitty of them. And he screams a lot.
Robert nodded toward his son. You nurse him all the time, so I can never feed him or get near you. I thought it was going to be wonderful, but it's been miserable. Your parents constantly say how irresponsible I am, as though I can't hear them. And I think we got separated because they told you to.
We got separated because you are irresponsible. Look what you just did,
she said, and he hung his head in shame. But he'd been desperate and didn't know what else to do. I just thought if I could take him away for a while, we'd get to know each other, and I could get used to being a father without everyone breathing down my neck.
Why Japan?
I saw it on the internet, and it looked nice. He was as unrealistic as ever, but he wasn't a bad person. She had been in love with him in the beginning, but she had hated being married to him. And her parents were right. He was a kid. Even at 25 now, he was immature. She was ready to be a grown-up and take care of their baby. He had no idea what that meant. And he wanted to let his stoned friends play with him all the time, or put Scott in a backpack carrier and take him to a concert where everyone was smoking dope. It wasn't what she wanted for herself, and she hadn't realized how unready he was to become an adult. Having the baby had shown her that in spades. He had come to the delivery, stoned, with two friends, and got upset when she told them to leave. She knew he loved the baby, but he didn't really know what that meant. He threw up all over some woman on the plane, he said, and laughed about it. He had an earache and the stomach flu when you took him, and you didn't take his antibiotics with you. She sounded like an adult, and he didn't, because he wasn't one. He wasn't a criminal or a kidnapper. He was just a stupid kid. But their son needed a father and not another child. And you could have both been killed on that flight. When I called your mom, she said there were brochures about Japan all over your room, but she wasn't worried.
You called my mom?
He looked shocked.
Of course. You stole our son.
Was she pissed?
I don't know.
She said you'd probably bring him back in a few days and he'd be fine.
But what if he wasn't? If you had an accident with him or went down on the plane, you'd break my heart.
Yeah, mine too, he said glumly. She thought of all the things he didn't. She always assumed the worst.
Do you think we could ever start over again, Ellen? We were so happy in the beginning.
We were kids in college with no responsibilities. It takes more than a wedding to make a marriage, she said sadly. He had been a big lesson for her, and her parents had warned her, but she didn't want to listen.
And what do you suggest we do about him?
And she gestured to their child. Robert looked blank for a minute as he thought about it.
We could leave him with your parents for a while. He likes them, and they're good with him.
Listening to him was like being in fantasy land, and he wasn't even stoned. This was who he was.
We can't go backward. We can't just hand our son off to someone else, and I don't want to. We can't start over for us. I can't do this again. I've hated the last 2 years, too. You have to go away somewhere and grow up, and then you'll be good for someone else, not for me. This has been a terrible experience for me, she said with tears in her eyes. But you can start again with Scott when you're ready to. I won't trust you alone with him again. I talked to my lawyer, and the court can appoint a monitor to be on visits with you so he's safe, until you can demonstrate that you're responsible.
He didn't say anything and just nodded. It sounded horrible to him.
I'm going to withdraw the parental abduction charges, and I'll drop the back child support. I know you can't pay it. My father said he'd help us. He's putting money aside for college for him anyway, and he'll give me some of that. But if you want to be Scott's father, you have to act like it, she said, staring at the man she had married who had turned out to be an overgrown boy. He acted like a teenager at 25. Are you really going to withdraw the charges? He looked happy about that as she nodded. And the child support. When you can afford it, you can start giving me money for him. I know you can't now, anyway. You need a better job than a surf shop or bicycle shop or skateboard shop. You need a real job. I'm not ready for a real job. He wasn't ready for life, and surely not for a wife and child. Ellen stood up then, and Robert looked at her sadly.
You really don't want us to try again?
No, I don't, she said firmly.
We were great for a while.
He smiled at her.
No, we weren't. We were stupid kids, and we never should have gotten married. But I'm glad we have Scott.
She gazed tenderly at their baby, who gurgled at her.
Take care of yourself. And I'm not paying your way back to New York. You can figure that out. I'll take care of the rest.
Maybe I'll stay here for a while. Everyone says San Francisco is cool. He looked excited about it as he stood up, too.
Do whatever you want, she said to him.
After talking to him, she had no regrets. She was glad she had come. It had been her father's idea. He said they needed to talk to each other as two adults and figure out what they wanted. She knew now. She didn't want him. And she wondered when Scott would see him again. Robert was obviously in no hurry to go back and grow up. She turned around and left then, and never looked back. An hour later, the charges had been dropped, and Robert was released from jail. He texted her one word. Thanks. She was already at the airport, waiting for her flight back to New York. She had done what she came for. Robert left the jail a free man. He checked into a small hotel in the Haight and went out to buy some weed. The neighborhood looked like fun to him. He got there just as Ellen's plane took off for New York with their son. Helen was surprised when Ben called her the day after the press conference to ask her how she was feeling.
I'm okay.
She was touched that he had called. I must be getting old. I used to do triathlons. I still hurt all over after 8 hours in the water.
You could probably swim the English Channel in less. Are you kidding? You were in a life-and-death stressful situation, made a water landing with a commercial plane, saved all your passengers, got swept out to sea, and hung in for 8 hours. I'm surprised you can stand up.
She laughed at his description of it. How are your kids doing?
Relieved.
I think I scared them all to death. They can handle the plane coming down better than my disappearing and being lost at sea for 8 hours.
Yeah, no wonder.
He wasn't surprised.
Do you have children?
She knew very little about him and was curious. They had dealt with an emergency together, but shared nothing about their personal lives. They'd had no reason to.
I never had the courage, or the time. I was married twice, and both my wives said that my work isn't compatible with normal life between humans. I work a lot, so I stopped trying. Kids never fit into the picture. Once in a while I regret it, but I don't think I'd have been good at it anyway.
It's never too late, she said, smiling. You might surprise yourself. Lots of men your age marry younger women and have kids.
Now that's a terrifying thought, he said, and she laughed.
He seemed like a kind man, and she thought it was too bad that he was alone.
We're going to Disneyland next week.
She changed the subject. The kids don't know yet. I love it as much as they do.
I've never been, he confessed.
It doesn't fit my image as a registered curmudgeon. I go to baseball games and play pool in bars.
Both my sons are in Little League, she said. I'm thinking about coaching. I played softball in the Air Force, in a women's league. I have to be mom and dad now.
That must be tough.
He was sympathetic as he said it.
Sometimes it is, she said honestly. You do what you have to do. Things don't always turn out as you plan.
He knew what had happened to their plans when her husband was killed, but she seemed to be a normal, well-balanced person and was doing all right, and it was obvious how much she loved her kids.
Well, don't forget about our dinner in New York. You look like you could use a decent meal. You probably never eat.
She was on the thin side and always had been.
I eat. We eat a lot of pizza and burgers at our house, and barbecue on the weekends. Jack used to do that. I'm actually a lousy cook, but a great pilot.
You can't do everything. You can tell my kids that. Have fun in Disneyland. She suddenly wondered if he was still in California and asked him. Actually, I am. The chief out here wanted to talk to me about something. I'm going back tomorrow. He's a nice guy. She wished him a good trip back and forgot about the call after they hung up. She had to take her oldest son to his baseball game in an hour. Life was back to normal. It was hard to believe that 2 days before she had been fighting to save the plane and had nearly died. And now she was driving to Little League games. Life was indeed very strange. Tom Burney picked up Catherine promptly at 7 o'clock at the Four Seasons, just as he had told her he would. He had made a reservation at The Sea, with French and Japanese cuisine. She was wearing a pale blue dress the color of her eyes, with a trench coat over it. She managed to look both businesslike and sexy all at once. And she was wearing high-heeled shoes similar to the ones he had noticed on the plane. "Nice shoes," he complimented her. "Manfredo Bizarro?" he asked, trying to remember the name she had told him. "I think you mean Manolo Blahnik. And no, these aren't, unfortunately. But I like Manfredo Bizarro." "I'm not up on women's fashion," he confessed, and they settled down at their table and ordered wine, before they looked at the menu. "How did the interview go?" He was curious to know, and she seemed very pleased, so he suspected it had gone well. She glanced at him conspiratorially, and it struck him how beautiful she was. "I got the job," she whispered, and beamed at him. "I think they felt sorry for me because of what happened on the flight out, so I got the sympathy vote. But whatever the reason, I got it, and it's just what I wanted. I'm moving out here in a month. They're going to let me use a company apartment until I find one. It's perfect," she said happily, as she sipped her wine. "Congratulations. I'm pleased for you." He had news of his own in that department, and shared it with her after they ordered dinner. "I have a new job, too. Or actually an old job. Or a new job with my old company." "That sounds confusing," she laughed at him. "I gave notice where I'm working a while back, after some personal disagreements with the CEO. Our egos got involved, so I think I may have been a little hasty in my decision. I had a bad case of ruffled feathers. In any case, I met with our CEO today. We both apologized, and I'm going to stay. I'm really pleased about it. They've added some new features to my old job and enhanced it with a component I really like, which will mean more travel between our East and West Coast offices, and more autonomy and authority. So I'm staying where I am. I'd always loved the company until our disagreement, and I'm proud to work for them." "Well, that sounds interesting. After our conversation on the plane, I thought I was going to move here just in time for you to go back to New York." She was happy that he wasn't, and that his job brought him to San Francisco often. "It could have been Atlanta or Houston. I've been setting up interviews there, too. I have a grown son who lives in Chicago, and I was considering moving there. He's my only child, and he works hard, so I don't see him much. But I won't be moving there now. I'll be in San Francisco and New York. I'll just have to visit him more often. And actually, I have meetings in New York for my company on Monday. When are you going back again?" She looked horrified at the thought. "After the flight out here, I think I'd rather walk. I'd take the train, but I have to get back." She didn't look happy about it. "I could fly with you on Sunday, so you wouldn't have to fly alone. You can have 3 champagnes when we board, sleep for 2 hours, have 3 more, and we'll be there. And I can carry you off the plane if you can't walk." "Very funny. The champagne really helps. Listen, after the flight on Wednesday, you're entitled to do whatever you need to get there. But seriously, do you want me to fly with you?" She thought about it and nodded. "Actually, I do. Would you mind?" "Of course not. I'd enjoy it. That's why I suggested it. We can play Scrabble or cards, or watch movies. Or send each other emails," she said, smiling. And then she looked serious for a moment.
I'm happy you'll still be coming out here often and didn't quit.
I'm pleased, too. Being in the same city definitely has some possibilities. Do you have friends out here?
She shook her head.
Not a soul. I was ready for something new. I was doing the same old things in New York. I was bored with my job. It seemed like the right time to make a change.
I'll introduce you to some people. I have a lot of friends here.
Do you play tennis?
Not in a long time. I'm a workaholic, she admitted.
But maybe that needs to change a little, too.
I work a lot, too, and the enhancement to my job will increase that, but at least it's doing what I love.
Their dinners came then, and they talked about their work. He said he'd help her find an apartment, and she was looking forward to flying back with him, without a crisis happening. It seemed like a good beginning, and a first step toward her new life. He took her back to the hotel at 10:30, and told her he'd pick her up at noon the next day. He was going to drive her around the area and show her the sights.
"I've already had a good look at the Golden Gate Bridge. We can skip that," she said wryly.
"I wasn't planning to include it on the tour," he said seriously. He wasn't sure that he would be able to see it in the same way himself after what had happened.
"We'll do something else."
She had given him her flight number at dinner, so he could make his reservation for Sunday to fly with her.
"See you tomorrow," he said, as she waved and walked back into the hotel, while he watched her. Meeting her had been an interesting turn of events, and if anyone asked down the line how they met, they could always say that they had been on a plane that crashed. It was different, at least. And he liked how courageous she was, starting a new life and a new job in a new city. She was a gutsy woman, and she made him feel gutsy, too. He liked her a lot, right down to the Manfredo Bizarro shoes, or whatever they were called.
Chapter 15 Helen went to Connor's memorial service. It was held at a small Episcopal church in Marin, near where he'd lived. His children had flown in for it and organized everything. The flowers in the church were beautiful. The soloist at the service sang Amazing Grace, and after the memorial, they were sending his body to be buried in the family plot in Illinois, where one of his daughters lived and his children had grown up. His late wife was buried there, too, and it seemed like the right place for him to be, not in a lonely cemetery in California. They had held the service there so that his friends could attend, and there were about 100 people in the church. He and his wife had lived in Marin County for a long time and had loved it there. They had moved to California, Helen learned, when their kids grew up. It was a somber event, given the way he'd died, and she was relieved that she and her children were going to Disneyland that weekend, which would take her mind off the fallen pilot who had died on her watch. She felt guilty about it, since he had been trying to help her when Jason shot him. The whole thing was still so hard to stomach and to accept. She was touched by how gracious Connor's children had been to her about it. They knew it wasn't her fault, but she felt bad about it anyway, and knew it would haunt her forever. The trip to Disneyland was a big success, and they stayed 3 days. They did everything all three kids wanted to do, including all the scary rides and roller coasters the boys loved. She and Lally waited outside for them, and went on all the rides in Fantasyland for her, and bought her a Cinderella costume at the gift shop, complete with plastic glass slippers. The weather was gorgeous in L.A., and the lines weren't too long. It would be busier once school let out, but she had taken them out of school for 2 days before it ended for the summer for a special treat, so the park wasn't too crowded. They had invited Helen's father to join them, but he'd opted for a quiet weekend at home instead. In June, she went back to work. It was hard getting back into the routine again after a month of leisure, doing nothing other than following her kids around, driving them to Little League games, taking them to movies on weekends, having their friends over for slumber parties, and riding bikes with them around Petaluma. They all complained when she went back to work. She was flying A321s again, and her first day back at work was the hardest, remembering what had happened the last time she'd flown. The crew members all knew about it, but the passengers didn't realize that she was the pilot who had flown under the Golden Gate Bridge and landed on the water. By sheer luck, Joel was on her first flight to New York, back from his honeymoon in Tahiti, the color of coffee with a deep tan, and showing off his wedding band to the flight attendants he knew. He gave Helen a big hug when she came on board, and served her himself for the entire trip. She had a very pleasant co-pilot that day, whom she'd flown with several times before. Everything was perfect. When she got to the hotel in New York, she wondered if she should call Ben for the dinner he had mentioned, or if it had just been social talk. She had nothing to do that night, and Joel was seeing friends for dinner, so she couldn't have dinner with him, and it was a beautiful spring night. In the end, she called Ben when she got to the hotel. He was still in his office, and startled to hear from her. She told him she was on a quick turnaround and going back to San Francisco the next day. "You don't give a guy much notice, do you?" he complained. "How about dinner at 8 o'clock? I'll pick you up at your hotel." He had tickets to a Yankees game that night, but didn't tell her. He walked into Amanda's office and handed them to her. "Go. Learn something. Take a friend." They'd been getting along much better for the past month, and had found a secret mutual respect for each other, though he never admitted it to her. But he told everyone else how smart she was, and it got back to her. Ben drove into the city straight from work, after making a reservation at his favorite steak restaurant near Helen's hotel. They could walk to it, so he put his car in a garage. He was in the lobby at the appointed time, and she came downstairs quickly, wearing jeans and a red sweater. She looked young and more relaxed than in her uniform. He took off his tie and stuffed it in his pocket the minute he saw her. The place he took her to had a cozy, old-fashioned atmosphere, half English pub and half New York bar. It had a pool table. He liked to play sometimes, and he challenged her to a game before dinner, when she said she used to play a lot in the Air Force. She beat him squarely, and he was a good sport about it, and said they'd have to play again after dinner, when hopefully she'd be tired and relaxed enough to take the edge off her game. She didn't drink at all, since she was flying in the morning, and they talked a lot. He was an interesting person, and his years with Homeland Security, the Justice Department before that, and as a police detective when he was younger, had been busy and exciting. He had come up through the ranks, and surprised her when they finished the meal and he told her he had a new job. "After all that, you're leaving Homeland Security?" "Not exactly. Moment of madness. I'm moving. I had a bad case a couple of months ago, and figured I needed a change to get it out of my head." "I know about those," she said quietly. "Alan Wexler, the San Francisco chief, is retiring. Since he credits me for helping to save the Golden Gate Bridge, he offered the job to me as a favor. I thought it was a crazy idea at first, but then I didn't." He had talked to Mildred Stern, and she liked the idea for him, but he didn't tell Helen that. He thought she'd think he was weird or neurotic if she knew he'd seen a shrink, which Mildred told him was an antiquated theory. "Crazy people are the only ones who don't see a shrink," she'd told him. "Watch out for them. They've got some good people out there, and it's a smaller office. Maybe a little less pressure, which would be nice. And the truth is, I don't have any personal ties here. I don't have kids. I don't have a girlfriend. I've been divorced for a long time. I have some friends and my job. I can always come back here if I want to, but I kind of like the idea of California for a change. That's why Jack and I wanted to move there, and my father retired there. Nice quality of life, and in my case, good for the kids. In yours, maybe you'll miss the big city." He shook his head when she said it. "As long as they have a baseball stadium, I'll be happy. And they have a good team out there." She knew all about that. "My sons love to go, too. They're big Giants fans. So you took it?" He nodded, looking a little stunned himself. "I did. About 2 weeks ago. I almost called you for advice, but I figured you have enough on your hands." "So when are you moving out?" "In 6 weeks. They have an apartment I can use for a while, in kind of a lousy neighborhood, but I don't care. I think I want to live in the country, like Marin County or something. I took a look around when I was there."
She was smiling as he said it, and thought it was brave of him and sounded exciting. Moving to a new city wasn't easy, but he didn't have schools to worry about, or kids, or all that went with it.
"That sounds great, Ben," she said, looking genuinely enthusiastic. And with that, he challenged her to another game of pool, since they'd finished dinner. This time, he beat her. He tried to coax her into another game. He was enjoying her company too much to leave, and the evening had flown for both of them.
"I can't. I have to get up at 4:30 to make my plane, and I'll be a mess if I don't get some sleep." Although she hadn't slept well for the past month anyway, but it was getting better.
"There's a great bar in Petaluma where I live, with a pool table. I'll take you there."
"I'd like that," he said, looking down at her. She was exactly the kind of woman he was attracted to. Quiet, honest, gutsy, fun to be with, smart, real. He hadn't met anyone like her in a long time, and wasn't sure he would again.
"Dinner again next time you're here?" he asked her hesitantly.
"Sure." She made it easy. She could sense what he was asking her. "You'll have to come to one of our barbecue nights and meet my kids." She was letting him know she liked him in answer to his unspoken question.
"Maybe I could take you all to a baseball game sometime."
She laughed at the suggestion. "We're a pretty rowdy group, and I'm as bad as they are. I think I can take it." They sounded like good kids to him, and she was a good woman. He had realized afterward that he had liked her when he heard her on the satcom when he was warning her about Jason Andrews. And he realized how much he cared about her when he saw her land the plane under the bridge and do everything she could to keep it floating until everyone was out. And then she'd disappeared, and he'd been terrified she was dead. When they finally pulled her out of the water in the harness, and she looked like a drowned rat, he had never seen a more beautiful sight in his life, and he wanted to know her better.
"I really enjoyed dinner tonight," he said, smiling at her.
"You won't for long," she said confidently. "I'm not letting you beat me at pool again. I think I was tired."
"Yeah, whatever. Sore loser. You had a headache, right?"
"Exactly." They were both good players, and he knew that was going to be fun, too. He liked everything about her so far.
"When are you coming back here again?" he asked, trying to sound casual about it.
"Twice a week for the next month," she answered, and he was pleased. "Good. Pool and dinner." He was smiling at the idea.
"You're going to be tired of me before you ever come to California," she warned him. She'd had a nice time, too.
"I doubt that.
You know what they say about Air Force pilots? They're pretty dull."
He laughed out loud at what she said.
"Captain Smith, if there is one thing no one is ever going to say about you, it's that you're dull. You're the most exciting woman I've ever met." And she could see he meant it.
"Flattery will not induce me to let you win at pool," she said. "Although I'll admit, it's a nice touch.
Go get some sleep, and call me the next time you're coming back. And try to give me more than 2 hours' notice. I gave up a Yankees game for you tonight." But he looked like he had no regrets. She was instantly embarrassed.
"I'm really sorry," she said sincerely.
"Don't be. I had a better time with you. Good night."
He kissed her lightly on the cheek, and she walked back into the hotel. Ben walked down the street to the garage whistling. It turned out that the move to California was not such a crazy idea after all.
Chapter 16. The notice came to each of them on the 1st of October. Helen had no inkling of it whatsoever, or who would have recommended her for it. She had been invited to an award ceremony in Washington, D.C. on the 15th of November, where she was to be given a Presidential Medal of Honor for bravery above and beyond the call of duty. It was the highest and most prestigious personal military decoration normally given to members of the armed forces. They were giving it to her after her years of service. She didn't know who to ask or tell about it, other than her father, and when Ben came to dinner with her and the kids that night, as he did often now, she tried beating around the bush about it, because she didn't want to hurt his feelings or make him feel left out.
Why?
Are you getting some kind of award? He asked her, with a look of innocent surprise.
No, well, actually I heard about it, but nobody has said anything to me, she said, and he laughed at her.
Helen Smith, you are a terrible liar. It's the Presidential Medal of Honor, and they're giving me the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which was the highest civilian award for his contribution to the security and national interests of the United States. So you don't have to be polite about it. I'll call around tomorrow and see who else is getting it. My guess is it's everyone who was involved in the Golden Gate Bridge rescue caper.
Oh.
She felt much better when he said that. I didn't want you to feel bad about it, she said, and he kissed her while the children were out of the room. They knew that their mother and Ben were dating, but she didn't think they needed to see the details or the evidence of it at their ages. But they were crazy about him, and he was enjoying them, too. He took the boys to sports games a lot and had dinner with them several times a week. The next day, he had the whole list for her. She was getting an award, and so were Ben, Phil, the head of the New York office of Homeland Security, Alan, the head of the San Francisco office at the time it happened, Tom Burney, Dave Lee, the head of airport security at JFK, Bernice Adams, the TSA agent. Connor Gray was receiving it posthumously, and the entire flight crew that day, Joel, Nancy, Bobby, Jennifer, and the others. Helen was getting the Medal of Honor, and all the others were getting the Medal of Freedom.
"Wow, I think we should go," Helen said, studying the list. They hadn't left any of the key players out, which made her feel better about it. She didn't want to be singled out, and she hadn't been. Saving the passengers had been a team effort.
"Of course we should go, and take the kids," he said. "They should see you get it."
"And you?" she reminded him. She had invited her father to go as well. He was very proud of her, and so were her kids.
Helen made flight and hotel reservations for them the next day. Ben was flying with them, but she thought he should still have his own hotel room, just for the sake of appearances for the kids, although Ben thought they had figured it out over the summer, the boys anyway, since they were older than Lally. Ben and her father got along well, too. They had played golf together several times and wanted to go to Giants spring training and were going to take the boys.
Helen saw Joel on a flight a week later, and he said that he and Kevin were going to Washington, too. The whole thing was very exciting, and her kids could hardly wait to meet the president, since he would be giving them the medals himself. Oliver was going to write about it as a project for school.
Tom called Catherine at the office as soon as he got the invitation, and asked her to go as his date. Things were going well between them, and they both loved their jobs. They were spending almost every weekend together, since he spent most of them in San Francisco, and at least 2 full weeks a month. They had gone to Chicago for a weekend, and she'd met his son. It was the kind of relationship they had both wanted and never found till now. And when Bernice opened the envelope, she sat and held it in her hands for a long time. She picked Toby up from school, and when they got home, she told him. "Remember when you said you wanted to go to Washington and meet the President of the United States?"
"Yeah,"
he nodded.
"Do you still want to?"
Toby nodded, and she hugged him tight.
"Well, he's going to give me a medal for the thing I did about the postcard and the bad guy who wanted to hurt the bridge, and you're coming with me."
He was the most important person in her life. She had started a new job in September at a Wall Street law firm, just like she had promised him. She had graduated from law school and taken the bar exam that summer, and she was waiting for the results. They had taken her on as a junior lawyer in the meantime, for more money than she'd ever dreamed of. She had left TSA in August, and Denise had wished her luck. There was a farewell lunch for her, and Bernice had been stunned when Denise hugged her when she left, and Della cried.
"Can I have a medal, too?"
Toby asked her.
"You can have mine," she promised him. "And we've got to get you a suit to go to Washington, and I need a new dress."
It was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to her. A presidential medal, for her contribution to security and the national interests. She was smiling from ear to ear, just thinking about it. The sky was gray the morning of the award ceremony, but none of them cared, as they arrived separately at the entrance to the White House, showed their identification, said what state they were from, and a smiling guard said, "Welcome to the White House." The ceremony was to be held in the Blue Room, on the state floor, which was used for greeting important dignitaries. It was a beautiful oval room, with a blue oval rug, blue drapes, and upholstered antiques. It had a view of the South Lawn, and was perfect for an occasion such as this. Catherine had come with Tom Burney as his date. She was living in Palo Alto, and Tom was planning to move in over the holidays. Ben was happy to see Phil and find out what was happening in New York. He introduced him to everyone, and it was like old home week when Dave Lee showed up from the airport. The whole flight crew was there, Joel with Kevin, Bobby and Annette, and Jennifer, the chief purser on the flight, and the other flight attendant in first class. They had gotten everybody out that day. Helen was startled and pleased to see Nancy, 7 months pregnant, and Peter had come with her with their newly adopted daughter from Beijing, whom they had named Jade. And Connor Gray's children were there with his grandchildren, huddled in a corner, looking somber but proud. Helen's children were so excited for her they could hardly contain themselves as they asked when it was going to start. And she introduced her father and Ben to everyone. She had bought new suits for the boys, and Lally a new pink dress. And she had bought a white suit that was the most expensive outfit she'd ever owned, and Ben beamed whenever he looked at her. The last one to arrive was Bernice Adams, looking very stylish in a red dress and a black coat, with black suede high heels, her hair freshly done in a bun, and her son Toby in a black velvet suit. She went over to talk to Ben, whom she recognized, and he introduced her to Helen and her children. Lally and Toby were the same age. "It's an honor to meet you," Bernice said to Helen, looking awestruck for a minute. "You're the one who saved us. If you hadn't called about the postcard, the bridge and the plane would have gone down. It all started with you, so we're all thrilled to meet you." "Are you still with TSA?" Helen asked her, and Bernice smiled a wide ivory smile. "I graduated from law school in June and took the bar last summer. I'm working for Harper Steinman and Coles," she said proudly. "Good job," Helen said, duly impressed. "That's terrific." She loved stories of women who had fought their way up from the bottom and made it. The president came in a few minutes later and addressed all of them and said how much they deserved the medals he was about to give them. "You saved a national landmark and your passengers' lives. We will owe you a debt forever. And you serve as an example to us all. Each one of you is a hero." He handed out the medals to each of them then, shook their hands and spoke to them for a few minutes. And he wished Nancy luck with the baby, and she thanked him. It wasn't due till January, but she looked like she was going to pop any minute. He spent a little more time with Helen. She had worn all her military medals on her new white suit, and he added the Presidential Medal on it. She already had the Air Force Cross and the Air Force Distinguished Service Medal from her tours of duty as an Air Force pilot. They were two of the highest medals the military gave. "We're very proud of you, Captain. We're proud of all of you," he said, addressing the group, and especially the children. "It's very important for all of us to try to be heroes in our daily lives." As he said it, Helen knew again that it wasn't something you tried to do. It was something that happened to you, an accident of circumstance, and you became a hero without ever meaning to. It was what had happened to all of them. They had gotten up in the morning and had gone to work, never thinking that anything different was going to happen to them. And then it had. They were all accidental heroes, no matter what the medal said, but brave men and women nonetheless. The End. This book was read for you by Jim Frangione, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Accidental Heroes by Danielle Steele.
Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries throughout RB Digital. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.